Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey friends, this is Cam, one of the hosts of the Gamer Heroes Podcast. We really hope you're enjoying the show you're listening to right now, and if you are, please consider becoming a patron of the Heroes Podcast Network at patreon.com/heroespodcasts. Your support would genuinely mean the world to us and would allow us to cover hosting costs for the website, get new equipment and software, and even make it out to different conventions and events to meet you, our loyal listeners. All Patreon tiers will get you access to the Patron Lounge and Slack, which will allow you to chat and interact with your favorite HPN hosts. On behalf of everyone here at HPN, thank you all so much for your continued support. We really couldn't do any of this without you.
Hey everybody, Derek here, old host of Gamer Heroes and host over at Screen Heroes, a sibling podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I have a special episode for you today. We were able to sit down with and interview Daniel Fox, who is the man behind the Zweihänder RPG. It's a fantasy, grim fantasy, dark fantasy RPG that's out there now. You can get the cool core rule set, and there's some additional books coming out here later this year in September and December. So this was really cool. He's in Kansas City, so he's local to where we are, which is great. And I brought on my buddy John Hall to do the interview because he is our resident expert in tabletop gaming. I hope that you like the interview, so let's do it.
So we're talking with Daniel D. Fox, the designer of the Zweihänder Grim and Perilous RPG. Zweihänder won the Any Gold for Best Game and Product of the Year at Gen Con 2018, was featured on Forbes.com, and ranked one of the best-selling fantasy tabletop role-playing games at DriveThruRPG, and has moved over 90,000 copies worldwide. And those numbers may be up from when we...
Just a tick.
So I'll let him unpack that. But so this game, it's a bloodier, a grittier version of the classic tabletop role-playing game, and it attempts to break a lot of the tropes that are usually associated with genre while also paying homage to its roots. So, Daniel, you were able to successfully kickstart the game and parlay that into a role as executive creative director of games for Andrews McNeil Universal. And we are going to try to unpack as much of that as we can, but first, congratulations on the
game.
Thank
you. I appreciate that.
And all the success, and thanks for taking the time with us today. It's been a pleasure to kind of get to know you over the last couple of days or read about you and talk to you. So tell us about how this game happened. How did it start?
Great. Well, first off, thank you, Derek and John, for having me. This is a cool opportunity, and I really appreciate the time to talk about kind of my experience. I think that oftentimes with tabletop role-playing game designers, they kind of don't quite have the opportunity with some channels to talk about kind of their successes and their failures, because I think we just spoke yesterday, failures is important to success. So I think it's important to talk about kind of like how where things start, right?
Right.
So, you know, I look back, so I started playing Dungeons & Dragons when I was 11, and I'm going way back here. So I'm 42, just for our listeners. So I started playing when I was around 11 and a half. And as time went on, you know, I've kind of been gaming with the same people for years at this point. You know, we grew up in Oak Grove, Missouri, moved to Kansas City in our 20s, and most of us are still in connection. We still game every Wednesday. Today's Wednesday. We're gaming tonight in my basement, you know, but now, you know, we've got cool tables and don't have to have mom make us brownies, make our own brownies. But no, the game kind of started, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago. So I had been... I've been house ruling Dungeons and Dragons for years, and I just couldn't get it to work with the type of game I wanted to run. The games that I run are kind of heavy on the politics, heavy on the gray morality scale. We shy away from the good versus evil stuff. There's not really a lot of monsters in our game. It's mostly like people kind of fighting, getting to the human condition, like a world that changes the people, not the people changing the world. So it's not like high heroics. So after fiddling with Dungeons & Dragons through all of its various iterations, and this was during the Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition, I got my hands on Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. I was like, gosh, this is a really cool system. It's a skill-based system. It answers for a lot of the problems that I've been trying to solve for years. I was introduced to it from Phil Kilgore at Tabletop Roleplaying Games. And I was like, you know, I love this game, but I can't use the world because I'm my own campaign world. I don't like the campaign world. Oh, and there's a lot of things about this that I would probably change in its own kind of subtle ways to make my own. So that kind of started this exploration around our game table to make what was ostensibly called Corehammer. It was literally a direct retro clone at first of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, but we stripped out the world. But as time went on, we're like, wait a second, this thing actually has legs. This is doing something that other role-playing games aren't doing right now. We looked at RuneQuest, we looked at other D100 games and other dark fantasy games. We're like, well, gosh, these are really interesting, but there's things about them that they just don't cover off on. So we continued development and wrote. And really that whole process started on Thanksgiving in 2012 in Minnesota, of all places, in a snowstorm. I remember because it was a Thanksgiving day, and I was up there with a friend, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to try writing an RPG. So years pass, and I've got this thing, this thing that I'm like, I'm gonna actually maybe publish this. I don't know. We'll see what happens. So that's how Zweihänder started, which eventually led to the Kickstarter.
Yeah, so one of the things I think is interesting about the game, we'll get into some of the mechanics a little bit later, but one of the things I found interesting in some of our conversations and some of the stuff I've read online about it is the fact that it is world agnostic. So that seems to be one of your design, like one of the tenets of what you wanted to try to accomplish with this, was to make it modular in that respect. Is that right?
Like, that's right. And I think that when we, as an example, like when we look at Dungeons and Dragons, like there are worlds that are sort of implied, but Dungeons and Dragons is built from a world agnostic standpoint. The difference is that Dungeons and Dragons accommodates themes, high heroics. Granted, there are alternative rules to make it more gritty, more dark, more violent, if you will, but they're not intrinsic to the system. When I look at Zweihänder, I look at it in the same way. How can Zweihänder, as opposed to high heroics, is low fantasy, more real and grounded and gritty? Like, think like street-level crime drama stuff like Daredevil as opposed to the Avengers. Like, these are two very different, yeah, although they're the same genre, but they're very different in their themes. So Zweihänder, you know, is the same way. It says, okay, we're not, you know, we're operating based off of themes and not world. Our themes are humanocentricism as a core tenet, fractured fairy tales, low fantasy, and a number of other themes that are kind of like intrinsic to it. But what we want to do is make sure we shied away from the more problematic themes of dark fantasy in general, which is oftentimes very kind of masculine, very centered around like powerful male heroes. And we knew that wasn't the type of game that we ran around our game table. Right. So when Zweihänder was developed, we're like, one of the core tenets has to ensure that we are showing characters within the book, within the works, within the artwork, that portray a number of people across a broad spectrum, to show them in these same roles, but you know, once again, to move away from, you know, having a world tied into Zweihänder.
Right.
I mean, there are things you could certainly pick out of it and say, yeah, that feels a little bit like Warhammer, or that feels a little bit like D&D. There's certainly little kind of like breadcrumbs, I guess you could say, but most of those breadcrumbs are there not necessarily to lead you toward a path, down a path toward a specific story, but to inspire you to kind of create your own things around these themes.
Sure. I was going to comment on the artwork too for a second, but I think probably one of the striking things about it, and I know we can talk about how the game, so let me back up for a second. You have this rule set, you've got this game, you've decided you want to publish something. Where do you take that? And we'll talk about the art. But.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so this to me is like where I kind of put my business hat on. So, you know, for the listeners, and I mean, John and Derek already knew this, but I spent, you know, 15 years at this point in advertising. I started out as a copywriter and graphic designer, worked my way up toward business development. I've been a coder. I've done all kinds of stuff. I've worn many hats over the years. But you know, I was kind of in my 40s at the my late 30s in the peak of my career, where I'm like working in client engagement, working on business development strategies. And I didn't know anything about publishing. Not a damn thing. The only thing I knew about RPGs was that I buy them. But I could also kind of understand, following ICV2.com, as well as listening to industry chatter, kind of how things kind of worked. So I was like, I'm gonna try my hand on this. I'm gonna see if it's real and legit. Because my intention, when I first developed this, was not necessarily to bring it to publication, but to actually print a copy off at Office Max. For us to have around the game table to play our own game. But, my playtesters, they kept goading me. And they're like, hey, you got to produce this. You got to print it. You got to do something with it. So, fortunately, during that time, when I was like, all right, maybe this is real, Kickstarter had been its two years of infancy. And I was like, well, if I'm going to raise money for artwork and a cover and print, I'm going to go to Kickstarter. So I started crunching the numbers. I'm like, okay, well, if I do a print-on-demand version at Lulu.com, which we'll talk about in a moment, it's going to cost this much. Oh, and I need to pay my artist in Serbia this much money. Oh, and I get paid for layout and editing, all this stuff. So I was like, okay, my initial ask, I think, was $7,000 on Kickstarter. So it blows through it in like 4 hours. It's like, boom, like $7,000 out of thin air. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, this is like people were paying attention, because I've been talking about this game, in passing on RPG.net. On Strike to Stun, which is like the Warhammer Fantasy role play kind of nexus at the time. And I didn't realize there was so much attention around it. Although I had kind of put some light marketing behind it, meaning I kind of drummed up a lot of funny memes on Facebook, I never really thought that it would start to attract a following on Facebook until I made my Facebook official page. So $7,000 happens in the first 4 hours. Or 7 hours, rather.
Like, it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to happen. So I'm like, oh, crap. So now, I'm on the hook.
I can do something.
I was like, maybe we'll do 100 books. And, it turns into, 1,900 books by the end of Kickstarter. We raise somewhere around $61,000 at the end of the campaign. We get a ton of new artwork in there. We are able to pay for another editor to come on board, because we hunted somebody to kind of double-check our work. And we ended up raising after that around $120,000 split between backer kit and Crowdox and other pre-sales.
Oh, wow.
So suddenly this kind of funny LLC that I started is basically a pass-through for taxes, for buying books and research material, turned into a real business. So I'm sitting on top of, almost $200,000. I'm like, okay, well, this is happening. So that, and that kind of starts this process to understand what it means to work with people across the world. So Zweihänder was not developed strictly in a vacuum in my basement. It was developed the playtesters, sure, but there are a lot of people who came to the table to kind of bring it to life. So the first is Tanner Yeh. He lives in Florida. He's one of the writing contributors, wrote a lot of the kind of fluff stuff in the background. There's Matthew Pook, or as he's known in the industry as Pookie. He's our proofer and editor. He lives in the UK. Our cover artist, Yusi Adaharo, lives overseas in Europe. He did the cover artwork. Our artist, Dan Mandich, who I got connected randomly online, he's from Serbia. And our layout editor, Milena Lakasevich, is also from Serbia. They actually live near one another. So between all of us, we cobbled together. And when I say cobbled, I mean literally cobbled. Because we didn't really know anything about the industry or anything about this. So we kind of took our first stab at Zweihänder. And it turned out to be a 660-odd page book that we printed. We intended to print initially at Lulu.com and do some print on demand. But as we got our first proofs back, it was like, oh, wait, this is
bigger.
Yeah, we can't do print on demand for this. Because we got the copies from Lulu. And for those who are listening who know anything about print materials, I mean, even if you're a gamer, Lulu, you print on Lulu paper, it's 60-pound paper, everything bleeds through, it's just a shit copy. It's not even Smythe-bound, there's no sewing into the plank. I didn't know any of this during the time, so I get that copy and I show it to the playtesters. I'm like, guys, what do you think about this? And it's really cool that we have a book, but you can't release this to the public. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're right. So I have to go back and recalculate all my numbers, because I had assumed... during Kickstarter, I'd raise enough money for shipping and printing and all that good stuff. So this turns into this big mess on the back end, which delayed the book by about 4 months. But what we ended up with at the very end of it, we got connected to Larry Elmore's printer, who's here in Kansas City, coincidentally. Guy named Bob Oddly with Covington Group. And he kind of said, okay, I know this world. He kind of is the captain of the ship. He says, let's write the ship. Let's go down the right path for printing. So he taught us about, like, print quality, material, covers, planks, ribbons, et cetera, et cetera. And when, by the end of it, we ended up shipping out a collector's edition quality of a book. It was soft touch cover, like what you're seeing here. Yeah. 70-pound paper, spine sewing, flat spine instead of rounded spine. Very, very high quality. Comparable to any collector's edition in the industry, and rivaling the standard stuff you'd pull off a shelf for Dungeons and Dragons. So we knew that, like, the quality of material was going to be something that we really honed in on in the future.
I was going to say, one of the things, I mean, I just comment, by the way, for those listening, if you have a chance to just go online, number one, and take a look at the cover art, which there's plenty of websites available for you to see. DriveThruRPG has mm-hmm. it, and the Zweihander, GrimAndPerilous.com, is that what it is?
Yeah, that's right.
GrimAndPerilous.com has it. Take a look at this artwork, it's beautiful, but I will say, just looking at this book today, I mean, it's substantial. I mean, 600 pages. It's heavy.
Yeah.
It lives up to its name.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, it really does. But you made a decision. I believe we talked about this. You made a decision to go ahead and have it be one complete tome, mm-hmm. Which is a little bit unique in the sense that a lot of the newer RPGs that have been coming out have, you know, separate player's guide and a separate DM guide, and it's very compartmentalized. But you went forward and said, you know what, we're going to deliver on that promise and do it all. So you want to talk about that a little bit, too?
Yeah.
I'm sure that was a big decision, right?
It was. And it's an interesting observation, too, because I think that, and this is just me speaking as somebody who buys RPGs, RPG prices have not really changed since the 80s and 90s. They just haven't. American dollar spends a lot worse, but the prices of books have not changed that much. So when I looked at the market, I was like, okay, if I'm going to make an entrance to market, this is me putting on my business hat, I was like, I need to do something that's unique. And part of that unique approach is making a tome.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Home that, although may seem unapproachable because it's one big omnibus, was price conscientious, particularly because we're printing in black and white at the time. The version you have in front of you is actually in black and white sepia. We'll talk about that later, the new revised version. But the original version was in black and white. We knew we'd evoke an old-school style. So we said, okay, Zweihander is a name that's fitting because it requires two hands to pick up. It's a big book, right?
Big book.
But when I started doing the math, here's the reality. So the Dungeon Master's Guide, the Player's Handbook, and the Monster Manual. So you can go to Amazon, you can add all the pages up, you can add up all the numbers. It's basically going to cost you retail price around $95 to get everything all in one, and it's less pages than Zweihander. So I was like, well, gosh, maybe we can do Zweihander in one book, because we did contemplate splitting it up at one point, specifically for Kickstarter. But it just something in my mind was telling me, like, you know, this is kind of a funny, cute thing. It's called Zweihander. It weighs 5.5 pounds. A Zweihander sword is two-handed. Like, we got to go, like, one big book. So we made the decision to do that. And it's kind of a – I have kind of a love-hate relationship with it now in retrospect. But there's things to talk about regarding that as well. But, I mean, nonetheless, you know, people really thought it was cool. And suddenly, after that, you start seeing a flood of other RPGs doing all-in-one books right after that. DCC is a good example of it. So it just felt like the right thing to do because, the bottom line is a lot of people have a lot of money to spend. And asking for $60 for a 269-page book is an easier ask than saying pay $99 for everything. Oh, and it's three books. Oh, and you have to haul it all around. But ultimately, at the end of the day, Zweihänder weighs less than all three books for Dungeons and Dragons.
Sure.
It has more pages. It costs less. And in my mind, it has more value. And even though we're not necessarily trying to compete against D&D, D&D is on the other end of the spectrum from Zweihänder. To go back to what we spoke about before, you have dark fantasy and high fantasy. Ingram and Zweihänder is on the other end of the spectrum.
And just a quick, I mean, just for people that are listening to you, just a quick kind of leaf through the book. I mean, this is 660 plus pages, and there isn't any fluff. I mean, you can buy books today that have 30 pages of rules and 250 pages of story and fluff. This doesn't have that. I mean, this is chock full of important stuff to get the game, you know, working. And I think the decision to, you know, set aside a campaign setting, so to speak, adds to the, you know, richness of what you have in the book. So, I mean, I'm paying you a bit of a compliment, but for those that are going to get this book, I mean, you're going to be really in for a treat when you see this, because there's just a lot of stuff in here. It's really good.
Yeah, we aimed for options. And even though you don't, you know, the requirements to play Zweihänder, don't be dismayed by the sides. It only requires about 8 to 10 pages of knowledge to get started.
Right.
The rest of it is mostly geared toward things that happen throughout the game, from combat to chase scenes to social intrigue to wilderness travel. And a full bestiary and a full game master's guide, a full player's guide.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're right. Because we made the conscious choice to remove the fluff of a world from it, give us a lot more room to breathe and talk about what Grim Perilous Gaming means. And to some degree, I mean, I kind of wax poetic. I get a lot of feedback on the book. And once again, people have a love-hate relationship with it. Either they absolutely adore the fact that it's large and has a lot of stuff in it, or they hate the fact that I'm long-winded.
I am happy you're long-winded.
Yeah,
so.
I'm long. I had never written before. No. That's the first thing I ever wrote. I never wrote a college paper. So I write emails. Wrote emails for a living for a while. But you know, like I had never written before. So I just kind of like said, okay, world, here's the way that I think and I write and though I run games. This is a reflection of the things that we've done around our game table for almost 2.5 decades. Tell me what you think. And people seem to like it.
So on that note, then, what really sets us apart? Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics. Because I know it has the D100 system, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I also think one of the things I'd really love for you to explore, we had talked about the professions.
Yeah.
And sort of the uniqueness of each one of those professions and those characters, which gives it a more living kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to lead you, but tell us about it. Set it aside. Sets it apart?
Well, let's talk about professions first. It's an important call out. So Zweihänder, you know, because it is about human eccentricism and about kind of the common person struggling against the world around them, the decision was made early on to avoid the traditional fantasy tropes of fighter, magic is your cleric, rogue. Those things have been done by 100 other books, and other books do it very, very well. I wanted to do something unique and different, but I also had to do it very, very well. So we made the decision to embrace the idea, like, how can we take Renaissance professions from our own world and turn them into playable characters? Now, there's 72 basic professions in the game. There's 44 expert professions, and those run the gamut from laborer to rat catcher to sell sword to black magister. I mean, they run the whole spectrum, like, for your traditional dark fantasy tropes to the kind of like in the muck and mud and piss and shit everyday people. So the big question was, how do you make playing a laborer or a peasant intriguing when you have all these other cool things they could do? Well, we knew that the answer to that was by using a skill system. Because every profession has an equal distribution of skills, although the skills are different, they're equal distribution across the professions, we knew that we could empower all of them to be useful around the game table. The second thing we wanted to do is, because if you look at Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, they have a career-based system, which is intriguing in itself, and certainly an inspiration for Zweihänder. But one thing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay didn't do a good job of is equal distribution of skills, and giving those careers something different that they do distinctly better than anybody else. If you look at Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st edition, 2nd edition, 3rd edition, 4th edition, there's nothing really unique about each of those professions, save for how they advance. In Zweihänder, different. Each profession has one unique trait that only they get. Only they can do it. Nobody else in the game can do it unless they adopt that profession later on in their career. So, as an example, when we look at the laborer, the labor gets a +3 to the peril threshold. And in Zweihunter, peril threshold, withstanding the rigors of stress, fear, and terror and fatigue, is incredibly important. Having a +3 to that value is a game changer. We know the labor is a cut, it's called backbreaking labor, I believe. And they can kind of accommodate, you know, like more fatigue over time. So we felt that was a good thing to do for them. Or maybe flipping them with the peasant, but nonetheless.
From a theme perspective, sure. They're working hard. They condition themselves to be able to do more.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
And same thing with the militiamen. Militiamen, like in the game of Zweihunter, look like these barefooted, like swords and spears thrust into the hands of, you know, scared peasants. But one thing that militiamen are really good at is guerrilla warfare. They don't provoke opportunity attacks when they move. So they have, each of these professions have one unique thing they can do. The smuggler is an example. Gets a trait called Hans Shot First, which means at the beginning of combat, they strike automatically. They go first. They get 3 AP to go at the very beginning of combat. And you'll find in Zweihunter, because, you know, dark fantasy can be a bit grim and dour, the book is just riddled with pop culture references. Not only just because the artist Dan Mandic from Serbia he's obsessed with American culture, because I'm a child of pop culture. So I've put a lot of that kind of like that self-referential stuff into it, and there's a lot of kind of fun in-jokes in the book. And a lot of RPGs don't do that. I mean, there's levity in the book. Like, it can't just be dark and grim and terrible. Like, who would want to play in that game or that world? Like, right. Where cynicism and nihilism rules. Like, no, what we're saying is these professions, these characters, these things that you're playing are unique and different and stand out from other rat catchers, from other jailers, from other laborers and other jesters and such. You are unique, and that unique thing about you is reflected through your professional trait, through your set of skills, through some of the funny kind of stuff that you find riddled in the book, and the use of fate points, which are your get-out-of-jail-free cards that only player characters get.
Sure. So then my question, or not a question, but more of a, like, maybe a little bit of observation or whatever is, that in the decision to move away from some of the standard high fantasy tropes of mm-hmm. wizards and fighters and that mm-hmm. type of thing, which I think is great, you kind of set up a situation where people can play roles, and I'm kind of flipping through the book here and I look at this, but people can play these particular professions that, and you can create stories that would give them an opportunity to kind of work through some real life type of things as well. I mean,
yeah.
Where... I mean, you can obviously assign some value to going on a quest and being a dragon, you know, mm-hmm. in a D&D type of game or any of these type of fantasy games. If you're dealing with, like, you know, the boot of the world pushing down on you,
right?
Which is kind of like one of the themes moving through this story. Mm-hmm. It's probably a little bit easier to kind of, you know, put yourself in that place if you're like, hey, I'm a backbreaking laborer.
Yeah.
You know, we can all relate to that to some degree, right? Like,
that's right.
I'm having to do manual labor just to survive the world type of thing. It'd be kind of interesting. I mean, how does that play out with your groups?
That's a good question. So, you know, this kind of goes back to the mechanics of Zweihunter. So, are you familiar with Joseph Campbell?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Joseph Campbell talks about, like, the character arc, the story. The traditional archetypical hero has three arcs, three parts of the story. And if you look at Shakespeare and other works are written in three parts. I took that in Zweihunter and said there are three tiers of play. You start out in basic tier. That's who you were right now. So I'm a run-of-the-mill gutter snipe. I'm a chimney sweep, or a person who's pretending to be a chimney sweep, but it's probably just a cut purse of sort, or a second story man. And that's how your game starts. You've been this profession up to this point, but something has turned you in a different direction. Some twist of fate, maybe some willingness of a god, or maybe just the world around you. Something has changed your fate, and you're going a different direction. So as you start out, actually mostly having completed your first profession when you first start the game, then the intermediate tier starts. Based on the story leads up to that point, you and the game master sit down and say, okay, what's the next natural progression? What next profession can I adopt? So multiclassing in a sense. So the story has led you toward a certain direction. Like, you may have started out as a steady watchman, but now you've spent your time as a mercenary for hire. So you make the decision to say, okay, the story has gotten me toward becoming a sellsword. So you adopt the sellsword profession. So intermediate tier happens. It's the second arc of the story. Then you have the final arc. So even though you may have started out small, you grow large over time and adopt that final third profession in advanced tier. And we see this in our games. We start out kind of at street level, gritty crime drama stuff, and eventually it turns into something big and crazy and fantastic. But the fantasy, the brushstrokes of fantasy are very thin at first. And as any good story is told, you tell it very slowly, let it unravel. Zweihänder tries to teach game masters to do the same thing. Start out small and slowly get into something big, as opposed to being like, oh, you're a fighter right now, you're going to fight a bunch of orcs and kill a dragon in two levels. Like, it's not necessarily about like plunder and being a murder hobo. It's really about surviving the world and seeing how the world changes your character, and that's reflected through the game mechanics. Your characters literally change and adopt new professions over time based on those strokes of the story. That's how we run games around my game table. We tried to do it with D&D. It was impossible. We tried to do it with Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. It just didn't quite fit. And that's where Zweihänder really kind of filled that gap for us. And based on what we hear, it's clearly a gap in the market. I mean, sales predicate that.
I was going to ask you about that. So why an RPG now? Why a tabletop RPG now? I think we talked a little bit about this at lunch, but let's explore that. There is a gap in the market.
That's right.
There's a mid-level right now. Go ahead and let us know about that.
Yeah, so game stores, if you look at the... So there's about 4,100 brick-and-mortar game stores in the United States. Of those, there's about 1,000 or so top performers. These are the people who have distribution into a GTS, Alliance, Diamond, Southern Hobby, the big distributors. And what they'll tell you is that RPGs are separated into three categories. They're separated into Tier 1, which is Paizo, Pathfinder, Dungeons & Dragons. Tier 2, which is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Call of Cthulhu, Zweihänder. And then Tier 3, which is where games are either so utterly complex that they don't get shelf space, or indie RPGs. So, and it's the first thing to understand about the industry as a whole from the perspectives of a game store owner. If you look at it at the macro scale, from the perspective of like a company saying, okay, RPGs are the right time to do this now. 2018, you know, ICBV2 reported over $200 million in revenue for RPGs. It's the fastest growing category for hobby games, meaning collectible card games, board games, plushies, bullshit like that, including tabletop RPGs. Tabletop RPGs is the bottom half of the sandwich, and collectible card games the top of the sandwich. And the distinction between the two is massive, in hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the entire hobby industry is about $2.65 billion. It's huge. So RPGs are a part of that. RPGs, particularly now, there's a very low barrier to entry to get in if you want to be a publisher. You can use Kickstarter, you can use print on demand, DriveThruRPG, do all these different things. But most importantly, and this is really due to Dungeons & Dragons, to their credit. So 5th edition comes out, and they made a marketing decision. They said, okay, Hasbro's marketing arm, who had been marketing toys for 5-plus decades, said, let's apply this same strategy to role-playing games. So Wizards of the Coast skinnied down in size, and they're backed by Hasbro's massive marketing arm, and they surround them, you know, and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. So they lock arms, and they do everything different than they've done before. They do these really interesting kind of releases for stories. Every year they do a campaign. They have slow releases, too much of people older player chagrin, because they want to see Planescape and stuff return. But the reality is that those things didn't perform very well, despite their popularity. So this has led to an interesting sea change in the industry. So now Hasbro is paying social media influencers to talk and play the game. They are working with Twitch, and LivePlay has brought a whole new generation of players in. Those players, mostly Gen Z players, have been playing for about 5-6 years since Dungeons & Dragons has been out. They've been playing 5th edition. And much like us, because we're all of an age where we started a long time ago, it took us a little bit of time after we got through D&D. We're like, okay, what else is out there? What other RPGs can I play? Talislanta, Palladium, Call of Cthulhu, Warhammer. This generation, Gen Z, is doing the same thing now. They've played D&D for 5 years. They've done practically everything they can do with it. They can play online with their friends at any time. They can do drop-in games through Adventurers League. They've been enabled to do all these crazy things anytime, anywhere they want. But now they're saying, like any curious consumer would be, is like, what else is out there? So now Tier 2 games, Call of Cthulhu, Warhammer, games produced by Modiphius, Star Trek is an example, are enjoying their heyday. You can see these mid-tier companies gobbling up IP, because right now is the time to start delivering games that offer something different than D&D. And this is where Zweihänder comes into play, and why I feel, anecdotally, why it's kind of enjoyed the rapid success it has in the past 6 years, 5 years rather. But it's an interesting time to enter because the market is not showing any signs of bursting anytime soon. And this can be attributed to a number of factors. I mean, if you look, like, there's luxury D&D game stuff now, which sells. Beetle and Grimms is an example, which is by Matthew Lillard, the guy from SLC Punk. He's got a luxury line of D&D stuff, and people buy it. So there's a market, not only just for Gen Z players, but for older players who are returning back to D&D and teaching their kids. And it's not something that we do in the shadows of our basement any longer. It's happening in libraries. It's happening at bars, like Pond and Pint down the road. Yeah. It's happening out in the open, and people are no longer afraid to talk about their nerdy subcultures.
Well, they're showcasing it on, you know, in media now. I mean, I'll just reference Stranger Things. I mean, that to me, when Stranger Things came out, it and I know that was, what, 3 years ago when the first season came out, but it seemed like from, you know, one night to the next night, suddenly D&D was fashionable.
That's
because
right.
of that show. And I don't think that was the case. I think it was building for a while.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of interesting to me to see that shift. And so, yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about that sort of being the lifestyle brand. I think Derek and I actually had a conversation about it and said, lifestyle brand sometimes is used as a pejorative to refer to mainstream. Like people say, okay, we're in a main, you know, something has gone mainstream or whatever. And I was wondering, because it said, you know, I noticed, or you mentioned that you felt like it was kind of contributing somewhat to the broadening of the fan base or the player base.
Yes.
So do you think that more people are playing because there are D&D t-shirts and coffee mugs and that type of thing? Or is it just, hey, I've got that shirt and I'm cool and I'm kind of in the zeitgeist a little bit?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
I don't think there's a silver bullet answer to any of this. I feel it's a number of contributing factors. I'd say the largest factor is live play. Critical Role and being able to play on Twitch, as an example, on YouTube, is like, that's been a game changer because now people who don't have friends who play D&D, they can just hop online and play. We didn't have that opportunity when we were kids.
No.
It's incredible. And it's not to denigrate that because I don't play online, but I also recognize and respect the fact that people do, and it's super cool. So now you have companies like Roll20, which was born in Overland Park, Kansas. It's now out in Reno. You know, they developed the first premiere online platform for playing D&D and other RPGs. You know, we've got a contract agreement with them to work on Zweihander. So, like, there's all these crazy things going on, including lifestyle branding, which has certainly gone mainstream. I mean, another thing I feel, too, that's attracted another totally different audience is the fact that D&D has embraced inclusivity. In fact, Jeremy Crawford, I believe is his name, is one of the lead developers on D&D. And they have made an active decision to ensure that the work moving forward includes LGBTQ+ people within it, and they prop it up, and it has brought out like a number of people who, you know, have been through a lot of challenges that we just simply haven't. But when you compare it against nerd culture, like, I think to some degree RPGs, and this is me getting a little bit poetic, but RPGs are a way for us to it's a form of catharsis. Yeah. It's a way for us to kind of channel some of the frustrations we have. Particularly, you know, I was a giant nerd as a kid. Like, I didn't have a lot of friends. I was not the popular kid at all. You know, and D&D was a way for me to kind of, like, kind of find catharsis and find friendship and build all these cool tools and things like that. And I feel that that's a large part of the reason why it's attracting a large LGBTQ+ audience now, particularly not just D&D, but all RPGs. So it's got this broad new audience across Gen Z. You know, it's bringing people back who are older back to D&D, and they're playing with their kids. I mean, some people our age have kids who are in their teens.
Yeah,
right. And they get to play D&D with their kids. It's incredible.
Well, I was going to say, to kind of go back to that for a second. It's interesting because growing up, when I was playing Dungeons & Dragons and Talislanta and Warhammer Fantasy and these games, Shadowrun was another one that was really popular, and Call of Cthulhu. It was almost as if, because it wasn't mainstream, it was almost as if those of us who played, we were kind of in the know, and we had the secret handshakes, and we had the inside jokes, and we kind of could refer to things in that way. And so I can actually see the appeal, I guess, from an LGBTQ kind of perspective, because it's been, because they've had to be, you know, kind of in the closet, if you will, to use a bad phrase there, but you know what I'm saying, in kind of in hiding. But they've been able to kind of wink and nod to each other and say, I know you're a part of this, I know you're a part of this. And now that it's more open gaming, right, it does give them a vehicle for that catharsis. I appreciate what you're saying with that, 100%. I mean, I think that is it's a very interesting insight. But do you think that if the games become too mainstream, that it might lose a little bit of that arcane kind of
That's a great question. So in okay, so there, this is a little bit kind of cast back about 7 years, but there's this kind of movement within RPGs called the OSR, old school role playing. And a lot of these OSR games are kind of like a callback to older D&D. It's basically like people saying, D&D is too popular, I'm going to make my own thing, go back to its roots. And in fact, some people consider Zweihänder to be OSR. In fact, I was called, I think, what was I called the other day? Like the king of SJWs of OSR or some shit like that. And I never called Zweihänder OSR. They called OSR.
Right.
You know, but essentially it's kind of a callback to older games. And I feel that, you know, that movement, it continues to grow. In fact, if you look at the innies this year, for 2019, the vast majority of games that were nominated are OSR or OSR adjacent games. I feel that there is some lashback going on against D&D. It is only a matter of time until these people who are curious, you know, from 5 years of playing D&D, say, what else is out there? Until it's happening. It's happening now, but it's going to happen in waves. And that's why these mid-tier, tier two RPGs are enjoying some interesting successes in the past year, year and a half. I do feel that that will continue to happen. I do feel that D&D, it certainly is mainstream. I mean, Stephen Colbert is playing it with Matthew Mercer, you know. I just read in Bloomberg, I think it's Bloomberg Business yesterday, about $500 game sessions that people are running. It's incredible. People can monetize their hobby, right? Can you imagine, like, being a 16-year-old kid and be able to, like, go down to the library and say, guys, give me $25 an hour to run a game for you. I mean, that's what people are doing right now through Patreon, through Twitch. People are going through a paywall to watch people play games. And they have that opportunity. And you know, we are looking at ways we can expand into that area, too, as Zweihänder. We did a contract with Encounter Roleplay at the beginning of the year. They ran Zweihänder for 18 game sessions. And our demographics changed completely. Because Encounter Roleplay and Twitch attracts a much younger audience who is of a mixed demographic, which is fantastic. And we're going to continue doing those sort of things because ultimately the challenge that any publisher is going to face, and this is just business 101, is like, if you're trying to market a product, meet your audience where they're at. And it sounds a little bit mercenary, but it is the truth. You know, like, I have a deep passion for Zweihänder and the things that I've written, the things that I've produced and work with my team to make. But I also understand that you can't just do things for passion. You must also find a way to monetize that.
Sure.
And now there's all these different ways you can monetize your hobby as a game master or player. And we're looking at ways we can approach these audiences who are curious and looking for other RPGs. And I feel Zweihänder is going to be one of those things.
That kind of leads the way on that a little bit.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit about that sort of voyeurism that people have watching people play games.
Yeah.
I can tell you personally, one of the most fascinating shows that I watched for a while was the tabletop game with Will Wheaton. Or his show where he just played board games with people. And that whole experience, and of course there was a little bit of the celebrity side to it.
Yeah.
But ultimately it was just really funny or interesting to me to see people who, you know, are kind of quote-unquote cool and
yeah.
playing games that I play, you know, with my son or play with my, you know, fiance or whatever. And it was kind of neat. But what is it? Is it the show Roll for Crit? Is that one of the shows? There's a show that's a Twitch show that is all about D&D play.
Critical Role.
Critical Role. That's Roll for Crit's another one. But anyway, you can scrub that out, right? Can you take that out in post? Critical Role, right?
Uh-huh.
They talk and they play games, right?
Yeah.
I have not watched it in all candor, but you want to talk a little bit about the opportunities there for. What you could see as...
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So I let me set this up. So when I first started talking to the people who... The playtesters who work with Zweihänder, like, keep in mind, these are some of these are my closest friends. So one of them is a sysadmin. He runs, like, a professional wrestling organization out of Kansas City. One is a VP at Bank of America. Like, these are people, like, big boy jobs. Like, not afraid to get in front of executives. I mean, I've spent my entire career in front of executives. So when I first pitched, like, hey... Can we put a camera at the end of our game table to record our game sessions? There was this kind of like, like everybody cringed instantly. And it was a big ask to get them to come around. I was like, well, here's what we're trying to do. We want to raise more awareness for Zweihänder. We want to invite people to our game table. They're like, we don't like other people, like our wives or husbands watching us game. Like, we like to be in our basement and not really show people kind of what we're doing. Like, and it was a scary prospect. And frankly, the first 5 sessions, it was a little weird. But we eventually got used to it, and we came around to the idea of, like, yeah, this all makes sense. So when we talk about Critical Role, I remember talking to my mom about this, and she was like, people watch you play games? I'm like, yeah, you watch football and baseball on TV. Other people are playing games. Why is people playing role-playing games not appealing? She's like, oh, I can understand that. So cut to almost a year later since we've been recording. We're about, I think, about 80 episodes in. We're about 60 episodes into our current campaign, 20 episodes into a previous campaign, and a handful of other false starts. We know that people want to see this. In fact, two of the playtesters, a guy named Adam Rose and Mike Bossler, who both were rules developers and lead playtesters on Zweihunder, set up a Patreon like to see if people are interested in watching, because we put it behind a paywall. People are like, $200 a month to watch us play. I mean,
wow.
I know. It's crazy. And there are other podcasts and Patreons that are doing this like exponentially larger. So now you talk about Critical Role, and they're making a ton of money from sponsorships in Dungeons & Dragons, because they're all actors playing a semi-scripted game. But more importantly, they're recognizable talent. It's like people ask, like, say, you know Matt Mercer? Like, everybody knows who Matt Mercer is. He's like the world's most famous professional dungeon master. Like, so there's clearly room, you know, there for other RPGs to do this. And in fact, other Tier 2 and Tier 1 games are trying to do the same thing. With Zweihunder, we're actually talking to Encounter Roleplay about doing a live play show, like with cameras in a studio and doing this for real. So we're still in the middle of negotiating that contract, but that's something we see coming in the near future. We're going to continue recording our games around our game table. I'm going to continue recording as many games as I possibly can with my new Meeting Owl camera. Because
I do like that.
Yeah, yeah. People love to watch people play games or listen to them play games at work. Like we listen to podcasts all the time at work. You know, like you listen to podcasts, you do your work. Same thing for like live play. People want to listen to it, watch it. It's a form of entertainment, and it's the way that role playing games must go. And this is the important reason why. And this is why I was going to come around to talking about Gen Z.
Yeah,
is that people who've been playing Dungeons and Dragons have an expectation now. Have an expectation of having a similar experience as Dungeons and Dragons. Now, any Tier 2 company, Zweihunder, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Call of Cthulhu, whatever, they don't have to compete against D&D. They have to compete with one another. You're never going to get D&D's market share. Sorry, it's not going to happen. But we know that people who play role-playing games are not loyal just to one game, but to many games. And these people who are looking for other experiences will look for experiences that are not so dissimilar to the one that they experience at D&D, meaning, can I play online? Can I watch people playing it? And does it have tools for me to play people across the world? An RPG publisher that does not have those tools at the ready will lose. Hands down, they'll lose. If they're not up to speed, it's not going to happen. Zweihunder, through Angels of Camelia Universal, is going to do that. We recognize and understand that we must meet our audiences where they're at and accommodate them in ways that they're already accustomed to, because it's the only way you will draw those people over. Because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to.
Right. Well, it's like it's similar to the way boutique hotels work, or maybe even craft beers, mm-hmm. in a way. I mean, you're not, you know, KC Beer Company is not going to pull market share from Miller Lite or from Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch, whatever, InBev. They're not going to do that. There are going to be people who are going to continue to drink Bud Light at their picnics, and that's that.
That's right.
Right? But they're competing with all the other local craft beers trying to get, and they offer something different, or they offer a different thing, or they connect with the customer base, or they, you know, have something that triggers them. So I think that's what you're saying, essentially, is you're going to be able to offer something different with this that people are going to be looking for to cleanse their palate of the sort of, and I'm not going to call Dungeons & Dragons generic, but that sort of mass marketed thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that's not to say that, and not to disparage D&D, because I love D&D, but D&D is Bud Light. It is.
Yeah.
Everybody drinks it. Everybody plays D&D. It's what you do when you're at a picnic. Like, somebody's got beer, it's probably going to be some shitty yard beer. That's your expectation. Your expectation is when you play role-playing games, the first thing that you look for is, like, who's playing D&D? That's the game that people know. But now, people are looking for bespoke experiences. Like, in the way to win in the industry, and not win, not necessarily taking market share from other RPGs, but being able to pay your bills, pay your people, grow your team, and so such, is going to be offering an experience similar to D&D, but with its own bespoke experiences. Like, what is Zweihunder doing different than Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay? What is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay doing different than Call of Cthulhu? And even though that we're not necessarily saying that people who are playing D&D will be loyal to just one game, We want them to, you certainly want to play all games, because I'm of the opinion that when the tides rise, all ships rise. Like, I don't, you know, the tabletop role-playing game industry is so damn small. It's smaller than you realize, even despite the fact that it drains $200 million a year.
Sure.
You know, a lot of publishers are working with one another to create things. There really isn't a sense of competitiveness that I've seen yet between them. I think that people online, on web forums, want to kind of bear that standard and say, like, you know, my game's better than yours, because that's how people are. But the reality is, behind the curtain, publishers are not like that at all. Like, you know, as an example, like, I created Zweihänder, and then 6 months later, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 4th Edition comes out. The guy, one of the leads on it, is a guy named T.S. Lukart, who I'm a massive fan of. The guy wrote, like, Warhammer Fantasy Role, or Warhammer 40K, Dark Heresy, a bunch of other stuff. Like, I was really afraid to go up to him at Gen Con, because I just won Best Game Product of the Year. I was wearing the medals, of course, the next day. And I'm walking around the convention. I'm like, should I go talk to Cubicle 7? Like, what do you think they'd say with my buddy Adam? And he's like, sure, why not? What are they going to do? Just not shake your hand? So I walk up, and the first thing he does, he literally grabs my hand and shakes it and says, dude, congratulations on Zweihänder. Like, and I didn't even know he knew me. Like, I knew who he was, you know? And it was this weird moment where I'm like, one, meeting one of my favorite authors who had, you know, I've been buying his books for years. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, and so we have this conversation for about a half hour about perceived rivalry and competitiveness and stuff. And it really opened my eyes to, like, what the industry is really like. And as I've gotten to know more publishers and creators in this space, and distributors for that matter, like Indie Press Revolution, it's become very evident and clear to me that, like, the RPG publishing industry within itself is not battling with one another. We're not embattled. And that's an important thing to remember, particularly as people are on web forums, you know, doing what they can to drum up drama, because people love fucking drama.
Sure.
Can I say that?
Yeah,
cool. All right, I speak French. So, hope you do too. But yeah.
Fucking French is great, man.
All right. But yeah, the reality is that, you know, people perceive this, like, rivalry between Zweihänder and Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and there's absolutely not. They both do two entirely separate things, and you can do both. Most people do. People who like Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay come to Zweihänder. People who like Zweihänder.
Yeah, it's not designed to be a replacement.
That's right.
If anything, I mean, it's a complement to, perhaps.
That's right.
You know, and it's a different type of thing. I'm just really intrigued to dig into this deeply.
Yeah.
Dig into the book.
I'll give you another example. So, you know, I was at same Gen Con, 2018. Artiles Lauren, who produces Cyberpunk and The Witcher, The Witcher book just came out. And people have been using Zweihänder for The Witcher up to that point. Like, there's, like, this huge, like, 25-page homebrew document on Google Drive about how to convert The Witcher into Zweihänder. Their main sales guy, like, I'm chatting with him. He's like, dude, I backed your Kickstarter. He's like, this is so cool. By the way, here, have a Witcher book. Did you buy one yet? I'm like, all right, buy one. He's like, no, take another one. Give it to your friend. So, you know, like, there's no sense of competitiveness between us. Like, it's a really interesting, unique industry. It's a cottage industry, you know. But nonetheless, it's, you know, to your original point about how do we capture our audience and how do we bring them around beyond D&D to something else. I mean, it's as the tide rises, all ships rise.
Yeah.
People are going to navigate naturally to an experience that will be complementary to their D&D experience, but does something different.
Cool. Excellent. I wanted to get one thought, and then we'll kind of wrap up here, I think, because I don't know what we're doing on time. I'm just going to check.
I'm fine on time.
Yeah, we're good on time, but we got to try to get this wrapped up and get out of your way a little bit. So here's my first question, and this is before we get into kind of the end. You made a comment about the mid-tier being kind of the bottom of that sandwich and the mm-hmm. collectible card games being at the top.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just pure vanity, what your thoughts are on things like Keyforge and what Garfield did with Magic and these type of things. I mean, what's your thought on those collectible card games? I mean, truly. Keyforge was an interesting experiment. Okay?
Yeah.
And apparently Fantasy Flight's figured out a way to turn that into a cash cow, as these all are, right? I mean, Star Wars, Destiny, all these different card games, hybrid card games, whatever. But what's your thoughts about that? I mean, from a game designer, from a publisher perspective, what's your thoughts?
So I will disclose first and foremost, I don't play Keyforge, I don't play Magic, I don't own any collectible card games. The last collectible card game I played was Spellfire, I think, right? In like the late 90s. So my experience with Magic the Gathering and other games like that is very, very limited. But from an outsider's perspective, collectible card games are clearly the king. Why? Because they are built specifically around snackable, digestible experiences. And what I mean by that is, like, I can walk into a game store, I can walk into a bar with a pack of cards in my back pocket and say, hey, you want to play some games? Just in the same way that you would play poker or something like that. But the difference is that everybody has their own unique decks. So I feel that that's kind of a, it's kind of an evolution of, like, backgammon or the games that our grandparents played when they're kid, you know, they're younger with their friends, like the backgammon tournament in the living room every Thursday. Like, instead, now you can just go anywhere with a pack of cards in your back pocket and go where you want. So clickable card games are intriguing in that sense. What does that mean for Zwinder? I don't know.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept.
Right.
It's not my cup of tea, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's not something that would ever be something we wouldn't potentially explore.
Sure. So speaking of that, now you've moved into, you parlayed the Kickstarter, you parlayed that into your creative director for games for AMU.
That's right.
Let's talk about that and talk a little bit about, you know, at least anything you can share about kind of the future of where this is going. And I'll tell you offhand, you know, the reason that we got to this point, you and I, with this conversation was, I met you at the store, and I was just intrigued that Kansas City has this sort of in our backyard movement for this, right?
Yeah.
There's an actual thirst for it. There's a hunger for gaming in this town, and this organization, AMU, is trying to, you know, make that happen. And you're leading the way with that. So fill us in on it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, I'd spent, you know, 15, 16 years in advertising, and it was around, I think, the latter part of 2017, I want to say. My father-in-law was like, hey, you know, there's a local publishing company. I'm friends with one of the board members. You should really talk to them about your next Kickstarter. Because at this time, I was working on the Mongoosh Kickstarter. I was going to do a new revised edition of Zweihander. I was going to do Mongoosh, a compliment to the book. And I just kind of blew him off. I was like, oh, whatever, you know, I'm doing my own thing. I'm just going to do what I'm doing, you know, but like foolishly. So time turns, and the beginning of 2018, and I finally get in front of Angels of Media Universal, in front of their board members and one of their key editors. The key editor, Patty Rice, is also the editor for Matthew Inman's The Oatmeal, the guy who does Exploding Kittens. So we have this conversation about Zweihander. I'm like, they're like, so tell us about Zweihander, but also tell us about RPGs. In the same way we're having a conversation now. And I'm like, well, here's, let me give you the 30,000 foot view, and I will dive down to the details as we go along. So I tell them, like, here's what the industry looks like. Here's what I've done. Here's where I think we could go. And they're like, okay, we want to publish your books. So I'm like, cool, you're going to be my publisher? Awesome. So they sign the contract, get a royalty in advance. And I'm like, hell yeah, like, this is awesome. And over time, you know, I get kind of passed around internally over the next 3 months between all of the executives within Andrew McMeel. Andy Sarian, who's the CEO, comes from a Hollywood background. Fred, who also comes from Hollywood. Kirsty Melville, who's the president of publishing. And they kind of decide, like, hey, we should not just publish RPGs. We shouldn't just publish Zweihander and Mongoosh and others. But we should actually do RPGs ourselves. So we have this series of long conversations around what would this look like? What would me as an executive creative director games own within the organization? What would I lead? How large would the team be? Where do we start? Where do we want to end? What would we consider success? All these questions that you ask when you look at, like, moving into a new business and eventually blossom into an offer. So I remember I had this conversation with my wife. I said, so Allison, my wife's name, Allie, you know, with a 3-year-old kid. I'm like, so I've spent so many years in advertising, and she knows I've been doing this, like, when the sun sets. Anybody who's publishing RPGs and working a full-time job and juggling a family and friends, it's, you never sleep. So I was like, you know, I think I should do this, but let's talk about the pros and cons. So we go through all that, and then we kind of decide, like, yeah, this is going to be good for our family, good for your sanity. and I could focus on one thing, because, you know, as a serial entrepreneur, like, this is not my first go-around. You know, this is my first go-around in publishing, but not my first business. I've had two other very successful businesses that I've sold off. So I knew that, like, there was something here, and I knew that if I wanted to make this a reality, to really make sure that Angels of Meal was successful, I would need to work with them as an associate to ensure that it succeeds. So they made an offer, and I accepted it, and
here you are.
It's right. I'm 65 days in as of today on Wednesday, and it's been fantastic. And, you know, AMU, Angels of Meal Universal for short, you know, their publishing arm, they understand books. They understand the publishing world. They understand how to produce, how to print, how to ship, how to work through distribution channels, how to get through to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, Books A Million, Indigo in Canada, Simon & Schuster, you name it. That's their network. They've been around for 4+ decades. I believe that since the 70s when they were founded. But they understand the book world. So the idea of role-playing games being literally a book, it's not a board game, it's not a bunch of figures necessary to play, it's just a book and some dice and pencils and friends. Like, they're like, we can understand this, so we should do this, because there isn't, like, a high cost associated with it. And what they're looking at is, how successful is Volleyhunter and other RPGs that we can acquire may be, and which will lead into accessories, potentially. You know, looking at cards and looking at figures and things like that. Those are all certainly, if I look at my crystal ball, those things are potentially a reality. But right now, my charge, my mandate is to make Zweihunder and its other games successful, including Mongoosh, a supplement of the Player's Handbook that's coming out in December, and a starter set that's coming out next year. So we're kind of driving toward, like, you know, like it's not, I wouldn't call it a grand experiment, but it's about, like, how successful can we be with this, and that will lead to other things. Will right. we acquire other RPGs? Will we broaden our network? Will we grow the team? And that's kind of like what I've been doing over the past 60-plus days, is defining that vision alongside Kirstie Melville, who's the president of publishing. She has a background in board games from some number of years ago, but she understands the publishing world. She's a wunderkind. I mean, she's an incredibly talented person. Who's had a lot of experience in publishing, and, you know, and one of the big things for me coming to AMU is that, because I worked in an executive role before, I wanted somebody that I could learn from, who can mentor me. And Kirstie is that person. She has a wealth of knowledge and experience, and, you know, with her experience, AMU's kind of publishing power and understanding among all the associates and creators beneath this roof. That we can make Zweihunder and other RPGs through AMU very successful. I have no doubt about that.
That's awesome. All right. Well, hey, good luck with that.
I appreciate that.
Really appreciate the time today, and I know the listeners will enjoy this conversation. I'd like to just leave it open and say, hey, we'll check in with you from time to time.
Yeah.
And do some more of these if it's possible. You can give us a little more insight on where things are going, and opportunity to plug the product, so now's your chance, so go for it. You can plug this and Mongoosh and everything else, so do that.
Yeah, so thank you both, obviously, for setting this up. Like I said before, this is all still very fresh and new to me. So having the opportunity to connect with people who are out there, have audiences already built in, who are already talking about RPGs, is an incredible experience. So Derek and John, thank you for that. I appreciate it. You know, Zweihunder is a passion project. It was for a long time, and now it's like a business thing for me. But I haven't lost my passion by any means. In fact, you know, I still have to write. I still have to create. Like, that hasn't gone away. As an executive creative director, and although my charge is helping drive the vision, it's also about creation. Working with our freelancers through Grow in Parallel Studios, who's the company of, you know, playtesters and artists and creators who all made Zweihunder amazing, from Dan Mandich to Ken Duquette, who's our new art director, to Sierra Stanton, who works here at AMU, to our publicist, Allison McNaughton, to, you know, Dan, Milena, Tanner, Adam, Mike, everybody who's kind of contributed to this amazing book. And I'd be remiss not to thank them for their time on this podcast. But nonetheless, like, I would say, you know, kind of wrap up, like, if you're looking for a different experience that is unlike D&D, that is not high fantasy, but what we call Grim and Perilous Roleplay, it's not dark fantasy, it's somewhere in between. That features people, you around the table wearing the trappings and clothing of characters, not the characters on paper in the world, but seeing yourself in these roles, you should try Zweihunder. I know you can get it at your local game stores right now. You can buy it on Target.com, Walmart.com. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble in-store. In fact, I've signed a bunch of copies out in the wild. You can buy it at Tabletop cool. locally. You can buy it on Amazon for like $40, like $37 right now. I think the retail's on $65. But it's chock-a-block full of illustrations. Dan Mandich illustrated 425 illustrations cover to cover, only him, one artist. Mm-hmm. So it has continuity within it. And it reflects his life's work, not only just with illustration, but also as far as Zweihunder. And it continues to improve with our new book, Mongoosh. But Zweihunder is a very different experience you've probably had before at the game table. It uses D100, so percentile dice. It's very easy to understand your chance for success and failure. It offers a lot of intriguing opportunities beyond combat. Oftentimes we like to feature, you know, social intrigue mechanics and chase scenes, which are oftentimes overlooked by RPGs, as well as like what wilderness travel looks like from point to point, like the Lord of the Rings, you know, Fellowship of the Ring, like across the world to Mordor. We have those mechanics built into the game, and I think you'll find that Spy Hunter is an interesting and intriguing surprise compared to what you're seeing in the market today.
Very good. Thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks again, John.
Yeah,
Derek, thank you so much.
Really yeah, thank you.
Cheers.
All right, so that was Daniel Fox and John Hall talking about the Zweihänder tabletop RPG Dark Grim Fantasy. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I hope it was a good conversation. If you have any questions, of course, you can follow Daniel Fox out on Twitter. He provided his handle there. And you can find John Hall, actually, in Flying Killer Robots. They do the music for most of our shows here on the Heroes Podcast Network. And as always, you can find Gamer Heroes at Gamer Heroes Pod on Twitter, and you can find the rest of the shows at Heroes Podcasts on Facebook, heroespodcasts.com for the Heroes Podcast Network. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, Google Play, you name it. And don't forget to follow our regular hosts at GGKC, GG_Kansas_City on Twitter. So thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.